podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the King and AI podcast. My name's Kelly Cates and you'll be listening to my dad, Kenny Dalglish, on this podcast and getting his thoughts on football issues about Liverpool, but also about other things as well. And the reason the podcast has come about is because of our family's charity, the Marina Dalglish Appeal, which was set up to raise money to help cancer patients and their families. So if you'd like to support that, that would be fantastic. As much as it's about raising awareness, it is also about the financial support, if possible. If you want to donate, you can go to anfieldindex.com/MDA, or you can go to the Marina Dalglish Appeal website to find out a little bit more about the charity and the work that they do. It's worth having a read about. It's a really great charity and it's something that's very close to all our hearts. Enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm not Eddie Gibbs, who's away today, so you're stuck with me, Gag Standard, as your host for this show. This is the King and AI podcast, and we are back. But before we begin, as Kelly said in the opening, please do join the very, very kind Reds that have already donated to the Marina Dalglish Appeal by going to anfieldindex.com/MDA. Anything you can afford will make a massive difference. So please do that. We all of us really appreciate it. So we're recording this after a bit of a tough week. A draw to Arsenal, lost to Red Star, but I'm sure the legend that I'm about to introduce will make you all feel better just by uttering a few words. I welcome back Sir Kenny Dalglish. How are you, Sir Kenny? And how was your break?
Yes. Very enjoyable. I missed Paul, mind you.
This is a change. That's a change normally. Yeah.
Just a wee bit much to go without him. But his mother really enjoyed it.
Very nice.
And you mentioned, Paul, there's no King in AI without some Dalglish sunshine. The shine coming up from his head all the way from Miami Beach. Mr. Paul Dalglish. Oh, how are you doing, matey?
Gags. Don't try and be funny. It doesn't suit you. It's not... You're a giggler, Gags. You're not a joke teller.
I am the audience, but I'll rely on you to tell the jokes today, hey? We haven't podcasted this for a while, have we, us two? It's been a while.
There we go.
So we're recording so close to the game. We thought we'd do something different. We're going to do some questions from subscribers today, a special. And the first one, Kenny, is for you, obviously. Mr. Alex Mansfield, he has asked, I'd like to get Kenny's take on the most revolutionary football minds he's encountered, both players and managers.
I would stick very closely to the managers.
Okay.
Because every time there's a bit of success, surely the manager deserves a bit of credit for being arguably revolutionary. If you look when Liverpool started to move forward and become a force, Shanks was a man that had stepped in there, and what he did was revolutionary. And what the staff continued to do from then on, through all the years of Shanks, who we've got to be grateful for and who should all bow down to, because what he did got the club where it is today. And without him, without the start that he gave us, I doubt if the club would have been where it is today and being the hearts of so many millions of people. But Shanks would start it off. Bob Paisley, Joe Fagan, Ronnie Moran, Roy Evans carried it on, passed it on to us. And when you came in, when by the time it was in motion and I was starting, I came into the club, everything was set in place. And it was, you walked in the dressing room and you conformed to the dressing room. You did. There was nobody ever walked into the dressing room and tried to change it, because you had no chance. Everybody else, there was only two or three coming in a year, maximum signings. So when that happened, they would never. They just conformed with what the players were used to doing and what happened in there. And I think that's the way that they set up the training schedule, the notes they took, the diligent manner in which they prepared themselves for the match. The relaxed way they did it, and then you not even realising half the things that they were doing were really effective and helpful to us. And you go on to other people as well. Jock Steen at Celtic, he revolutionised Celtic. Don Revie, he revolutionised Leeds. Fergie went in, did unbelievable at Manchester United. There's a Matt Busby at Manchester United. There's a lot of people who have been revolutionaries. And I don't think, I think you hear a lot of people speak now, and they seem to think that because they get you to eat your food properly, or because something else is done different to what it was years ago, it's revolutionary. I don't think it is. So for me, that people do a very, very good job. But to cause a revolution, you need to be making some huge changes. And I don't see a great deal of huge changes at the moment in football.
Who would you say in the modern era, Dad, would be kind of in that? You know, Ferguson's probably the most recent one you mentioned there, but who would you say of the current managers would?
Well, I would have thought Jurgen, with the way that he sets his teams up and gets them playing. But most of the principles are the same. He's got a high energetic team that he wants to work hard and wants to compete everywhere, all over the pitch, close people down. I think Pep Guardiola, very similar at Man City. He wants to get, attack everybody and get as many goals as he can for his team. And he reckons if he scores enough, they're not going to lose. So for me, they're the two that are whose teams I enjoy watching most at the moment. And you know, I watched a game the other night there, well, just the start of the second half, PSG and Napoli. And I'll tell you, Napoli didn't have to turn it on for 15, 20 minutes in the second half. PSG. Yeah. I mean, it's people that make it more than the managers, but the managers, they give their license to play the way that they think. And I think from a manager's point of view, Jurgen and Pep Guardiola, the two ones I would say at the moment are revolutionaries. Pep might just be following on to what happened at Barcelona when he was a player, and the principles and beliefs there, and he's taking that into management. They're always looking for a new line, aren't they? But the new line's got to be successful, and all these people have been a success in the past.
So, funny, Dad, I was having a beer with Gary Bailey. We're watching the Champions League games during the week, and we were talking about football back then and football now, and he said to me, he said it's amazing. Barcelona were on. He had Barcelona's laptop. We had another game on the TV, and he said Liverpool played the way Barcelona played now, but back then. And he said, look, I have no idea how Liverpool did it, because the pitches back then were nothing like what they are now. And that when the winter months started coming, that some of the pitches were very, very difficult to play on, but Liverpool still managed to play the same way when a lot of the other teams in England were playing direct. And he said to me, he said, look, that was so. To your basically, what I'm trying to get at, Dad, is that do you feel that a lot of things that people may find revolutionary have been done in the past with a different name?
But well, I think they use a lot of different names for simple things like transition. I think that's just a change of possession, isn't it?
Yeah. So they're just different words coming.
Aye, the game's it's not going. People's philosophies and ideas and how to play the game will have changed. But the game's the same, isn't it? It's still 11 against 11. It's still, the ball's still round. Still got a referee. It's still same decisions. And you score more goals than somebody else, you're going to win. But I think the revolutionaries are the ones that have made changes to the norm. And if you can't compete with a team that pass and move, then you've got to find an alternative. And even the boys at Wimbledon, when they started the long ball. By the way, I would have said they were revolutionaries as well.
But not fashionable. You know,
it's fashionable. Paul, it's not fashionable if they beat you.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny. I was.
But if they play within the rules, it doesn't matter how.
No,
you play.
I'm not saying not fashionable in a bad way. I'm saying that what's happened in football, in my opinion, now, and I don't know. You can tell me if it was like this when you were kind of younger back when you were playing, or but it almost seems now that it's not enough to win games. If you take Liverpool and Manchester United as an example, Manchester United finished second last year. And Liverpool finished fourth. But Manchester United won trophies the year before as well. We didn't. But if you would have listened to the media and the public and read on social media in the off-season this year, Liverpool were about to take on the world. And Manchester United were absolutely dreadful. And if you take into if you do a point total from the beginning of last season until today, we have one more point than Manchester United combined. And if you think about the public kind of perception of both teams, it's great to be a Liverpool fan at this moment in time. And that is, for me, down to two things: is our manager in press conferences is very, very likable and gets a lot of goodwill from the club. And the style that our manager plays has got us a lot of people that admire the way that we play. And I think that now in today's football, Dad, it's almost as important what you say in a press conference or you play a fashionable style of football, revolutionary, modern, whatever you want to call it, than winning. I don't think winning's enough. If you look at Sam Allardyce at Everton, you know, they finished in eighth under Sam Allardyce, but people didn't want to, he didn't get the goodwill either.
Well, it's a bit perception as well.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Jürgen doesn't go in and pick fights with anybody in a press conference. He doesn't go and pick fights with players. If he's got something to say to the player, 99 times out of 100, he'll say it privately and that'll be the end of it and nobody will get to know any more. Whereas but some stuff that's happened at Manchester United has been in the public domain. Well discussed, well versed. And it's the perception that you have that you can't tell me Jürgen's not giving some of the players a bollocking.
Mm-hmm.
But he's done it properly. He's kept it indoors, kept it in-house. And he's a different personality to Mourinho. But Mourinho also has been hugely successful in the clubs that he's been at.
But do you know what's funny? You'd say that Mourinho, Klopp and Guardiola are probably the three highest profile managers at this moment in time, definitely in England anyway. And they all play a different style. Jose plays quite defensive. You know, Guardiola plays quite offensive in his way with possession-based football. And Jürgen plays more pressing, counter-pressing type of football. So maybe all three of them have, if you want to call it revolutionary, or if you don't want to use that word, then that's fine. But they've all been hugely successful in different ways. So maybe they found a way to be revolutionary with their style of play in the modern era.
Well, to be successful, you've got to be good.
Yeah.
And you've got to have, you've either got to inherit the players, which you're very fortunate if you've done, but you've still then got to prepare them. You've got to pick teams, you've got to set them up properly to win games. And that result that United got the other night there.
Madrid.
That'll fill them with a bit of optimism getting into the derby at the weekend. But whether they win the match or no remains to be seen. But it'll be a wee bit more positive and optimistic at Old Trafford because of that. But that might only last to the weekend.
Oh, their fans are already very optimistic and unbearable again. So
here's the way I look at it. Maybe revolution is not the right word, but I think because there's normally, obviously, the fitness has advanced and the the speed of the game has advanced. But there's not too many new things that you see tactically. So maybe it's, rather than saying who's the most revolutionary in today's game, it's maybe saying who's the most competent at what they do.
You can say that the games or the players are quicker and the players are fitter. Well, why can they not play the same number of games as we played?
For that reason.
No, for what reason?
They're
because supposed to be better.
They have to
educated.
Cover more ground.
No, they don't need to cover more ground.
Perform more sprints. I would.
Liverpool won the championship. I think it was 89 or something, and we only used 14 players. And they players, apart from club appearances, they were also internationalists, most of them.
Yeah.
So how can they do that in a season? Nowadays, after two or three games, they're needing a rest.
Because for me, the intensity of the games, the amount of sprints you perform, damages the body more. Even though you recover better.
But Paul, they're supposed to be better. Better educated, fitter.
But here's the other thing. Here's the other thing. You played with injuries. Yeah. You played with injuries. You would play if you're injured.
Aye.
Today players don't play injured.
Well, they don't play reserve football either, do they?
No. So it's
when they come in to play a game, after being out for 3-4 weeks, it's understandable that it takes them about a wee while to settle. Yeah. And getting themselves up to speed with the game. And by the time they get themselves up to speed, because they've not played the games, they're getting taken off because somebody will think they're tired.
Yeah. No, they're trying to prevent injuries, Dad, because of the explosion.
If you tell them, well, we get injuries as well.
I know, but you didn't do as many sprints.
If you tell them they're tired, and they think they're tired, they'll be tired.
No, there is. Don't look at that fire. The first thing you want to do is look at the fire. But there is a part of it that, you know, don't put anything in the mind. But there is undoubtedly more stress put on the body now when you play a game of football than what.
But
there
Paul,
was.
What would you say about the counter of that? There's more. You know, there's more things to support players now. There's more, the technology's gone better, you know, to help them, to support them. And that wasn't there in the past either.
That's it. The recovery's better. And, right. And there'd be even more injuries if it wasn't.
Paul, how can the recovery be better if they can't play games?
What do you mean they can't play games?
Well, they don't play the number of games that they played. What?
Dad, if you could get, and I don't know if there's anybody ever done it. If you could get a device and track how far somebody ran in a game in even the 90s compared to now, and how much distance they covered at high intensity over whatever sprint speed is, you would find that the numbers every 10 years go up.
Well, let me tell you,
you're at more high risk to get injured when you perform more sprints. And what's the biggest change in football is people are performing more sprints.
Okay. But.
And that's when you're at highest risk of injury. That's why there's more injuries.
They also have, what is it, 7 subs?
There's 7 subs, 3.
All right. What did they have in the 80s and the 90s?
1. But Dad, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So the person that was on the pitch but has covered more ground. You take that. You can pick out somebody that's ran 12,000 kilometres. Right? Pick them out. But you wouldn't, when you go back to 80s and 90s, they could have been running further than that. And there'd be a lot more people running. You pick 4 or 5 out, they had to run. Now you've got people that don't have to run because, you know, their subs coming on. Or if they reach a figure, they say, oh, we better take him off, he might get injured.
But here's a counter-argument. Maybe people, because there wasn't subs, paced themselves in games. Whereas now people, while there's no subs, don't pace themselves as much. And if someone fatigues, they fatigue. And that's...
Paul,
that,
if you
but
have to sprint,
no, listen,
you have to no, sprint,
there
you
is
have
no,
sprint.
There is no way you can convince me that players cover the same amount of distance now as they did 20, 30 years ago. Paul, or perform the same amount of sprints.
Let me tell you, some of them, they cover the ground going after the first touch.
That's a different argument. All I'm talking about, and we've gone off on a tangent as usual, is that people perform more sprints, which puts them at higher risk of injury.
I'll try and see Paul and Sekendi if I can try and get any numbers on this for next week or the week after. I'll try and see if there's anything out there, do some research for you, and I'll come back and see if there's anything out there. But it's a very hard thing to do, because obviously it's all done by technology now, on players, which is what tracks it. But if there is anything, I'll come back. I think we're not going to get an agreement between you both. So let's move on to the next question from Edda Carl. Sekendi, again for you. From an ex-player and manager point of view, how do you cope with the pressure of high expectation when you are in a team like Jürgen is fighting for every silverware? Any result that is not a win is taken as a big blip. So how can you help the players cope with that pressure?
Well, surely the players want to be successful.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to be successful, you're going to bring yourself a wee bit, certain amount of pressure on yourself. And surely they want to go out onto the pitch and win as many games as they can. Well, that's pressure. I'll tell you something. If you're at the top end of the table and you think that's pressure, I would like to know from someone who's been at the top and also at the bottom to tell me which ones get the most pressure. Because I would have thought being at the bottom trying to avoid relegation is more stressful.
Absolutely.
Than being at the top going for a title. Of course you get nervous before you play a game. You're supposed to get nervous. I just don't see how you can. If you play football, you take pride in your own appearance, pride in your club, and you're trying to be successful. Of course, you'll get pressure. There'll be pressure. There's pressure in every job.
Can I ask a question?
It's how you manage it. It's how you manage it that counts.
Have you ever been? What's the closest you've ever been to? Because I'm trying to think. Have you ever,
no, Paul? I think you should try and think more often.
No, it doesn't suit me. But the what's the closest you've been to like even to a relegation battle? Because I'm thinking Blackburn, Liverpool, never, Celtic, never,
Newcastle.
Where you finished? 13th. Where did you finish? 30. So never really.
13th, and we got to the cup final.
So I've been at the bottom of tables. I've been down there. I've been close to the top as well at times. But the it's certainly not nice, Dad. I tell you, it's not nice because there's an embarrassment as well, you know, from being down there.
But obviously there's somebody got to be down there.
Yeah.
And if you take pride in yourself and your work and your respect for your club and the people that come and watch it, then I think that would be more stressful than being at the other end. If you're not successful when you're fighting at the top end, obviously there's going to be huge disappointment. But that's natural.
Yeah.
But it shouldn't make you afraid. You've got a better chance of being disappointed if you let the situation get to you.
Here's a couple of tangents for this question. One is, one of the, in cup finals, Dad, you hear the stories about European cup finals, about managers calling a meeting the night before the game and taking certain players down and letting them have a drink and saying, look, to relax them before a game. You hear about comedians on the bus going to cup finals or different things that people do. When you played in the European Cup final, you all started singing in the tunnel.
Yeah.
Do you think that some managers maybe go in the wrong direction by trying to motivate people for a big game rather than try to relax people for a big game?
No, I think the manager does what he thinks is correct. And what might be more suited. But it's amazing, isn't it? It's always after they've won that they tell you they've done something. Like they have a comedian on the bus or they don't tell you what they did when they lost.
Yeah.
They don't say, yeah, well, oh, we never had a comedian on the bus. That's why we lost.
Yeah. No, I because I'm just trying to think of my own experience, and I'm just trying to pick in your brain.
It's all psychology.
Yeah, I think it's different with different teams as well, isn't it? Because
different personalities within the team.
Some people are laid back and need motivated. Some players are kind of nervous and need relaxed. And you've got to have a one size fits all to people with different personalities.
It would be the same if you say the manager says on Friday night, you want a drink? Somebody will go, yeah. Some will say, no, I don't want a drink. So it's never going to suit everybody.
Mm.
And with a comedian on the bus, I'm sure some people would be on the bus saying, oh, I wish you'd shut up.
Yeah, I want to concentrate. Let me concentrate on the game. Yeah.
Half the lads nowadays wouldn't hear them anyway because they've all got their headphones on.
So, and that's another thing as well, is do you think that that individualizes a team more than unites a team?
Well,
the headphones on the bus.
But I think preparation has got to be partly down to the individual.
Yeah.
Right? You've got to prepare as a team, obviously, but different people prepare in different ways. And if that's what it takes for them to turn on a performance, headphones on, fine. But, I mean, it'd be interesting. I don't even know what's on the headphones, if it's just music or it's like the golfers when they're practicing.
They're listening to you. They're listening to you, Kenny.
Well, by the way, when they
never... That won't relax me. I tell you, that certainly wouldn't relax me.
When they never had headphones on and I was working, they never listened to me then.
You know what? I've got something for you, Paul. You know what? Just come in from a subscriber, Mohammed Kedar. You were talking about preparation there. How important is an assistant manager? So, Paul, you've just won pretty much every level that you were in with Miami, right? So how important is your number two in command and what do they do like for you? I think he's just really interested in finding out what a number two does for a manager.
Every number two is different.
Right.
And I think my dad will kind of second this, but every number two is different. And nowadays, you don't just have a number two. You have a number two, three, four, and five, depending on what club you're at. There's a team of staff. So you might have an assistant coach, a coach, a goalkeeper coach, a fitness coach, an analyst, a psychologist. I mean, the list goes on of the positions that can be filled. And one of the most important things you've got to do as a head coach, manager, as my dad was, is know what you can and can't do. So if I'm a tactical guy, but I'm not a man manager, then I might want to get somebody in who can manage the players and go round and make the players feel good about themselves. If I'm a man manager, but I'm not much of a coach, then I might want to go and employ a coach and I'll manage the group. So I think you can be successful as a manager in many different ways, but your staff that you put around you have to complement and hide your deficiencies, really. And you've got to be confident enough to go, I can't do that. I need to bring somebody in that can do that for me. And then everybody's successful.
Wow.
Would you agree that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. You identify your weaknesses and you get the best possible person in to help you where you're weak. And you're only ever going to be as strong as your weakest man.
Yeah.
And there's no need and there's no reason why you wouldn't get the best in. A lot of people don't like to get the best in to fill their weak point because they're afraid that he might take over his job. Well, I'll tell you, if you've got a guy that's really good at coaching, if that was your weakness, and you're successful, you'll not be taking over any job. But if you get a bad coach in, you're going to be looking for a job as well.
The other thing
as well, Dad, I would say is some people are scared to allow the staff to do the jobs. You know, if you're going to bring somebody in that's really good at what they do, let them do it.
Yeah. But also, Paul, what you've got to do at the same time is make sure the people that you bring in, right, when they are doing a good job, they don't overstep the mark either.
Mm.
You respect them for what they do And that's what they do. You can add your tuppence worth in private, but when you've got the game going and everybody's together, they cannot in any way, shape or form undermine the manager. And similarly, the manager can't undermine them.
Dad, I agree. I'm just back to the original thing about pressure of expectation. I've got a question, Dad, and it's relevant to, it's using your experience to look at Liverpool's team at the moment. And basically, when I look at Liverpool's team at the moment, I think there's only James Milner that's won the Premier League. And there's probably, I don't know, two or three others that have won a major league championship. So what I want to say to you is, is there a benefit to having won it before? I'm specifically was going to ask about how was it when you got close to winning it at Blackburn and you've got 10 games left and all of a sudden you're like, we've got a chance of winning this, compared to being at Liverpool where you had a team full of players that have won it before going into the last 10 games of the season? Was there a calmness or a kind of, we've done this before, we know how to do it again with Liverpool, or does it not really make a difference?
Liverpool normally had it won 10 games ago. Well, maybe that. But obviously, having been there before, right, you know, you've been through it before, so you've got a wee bit of knowledge of what that's about. But when it's your first time, of course you're nervous. But you can be nervous, but still responsible. And it must be more nerve-wracking when you haven't won it before and you're coming up for your first one, because you're moving into a little bit of uncertainty. With the ones that have been through it before, because they've been through it before, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to win again. So you've got every chance, every much as good a chance as somebody that's won it 10 times and you've never won it at all. There was nobody at Blackburn had ever won the league.
Yeah, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. You go through, I don't think there was there?
I don't think so. Off the top of my head, probably be 100% wrong, but never mind. I don't think there was. But they had the belief.
Had David Batty won it at Leeds before he came to you? With Gary Mack and
Lee Gordon? I don't know. Gary Speed? Don't know.
I think he did. I think that might have been the only one. But Sherwood, Wilcox, Ripley, Shearer, Sutton, Lassow, Berg. No? Tim Flowers. I think David Batty might have been the only one. So it was the same as Liverpool now with Milner.
Well, it doesn't mean you say you can't win it.
No. No.
How many had won it when Man City won it?
No, I'm looking at Leicester.
The first time. Leicester.
I don't think Leicester, yeah. Yeah.
So that's what, Paul, I don't know.
No, but what I would say is, I think...
David Batty definitely won the league, you're right, Paul.
Yeah. See, good knowledge, eh?
Not bad.
Good knowledge. There you go.
He must have had that conversation with somebody a couple of days ago.
No, I didn't. But I was thinking because, for a change. But I was just thinking, like, is it sometimes ignorance is bliss and you don't feel the pressure? And I guess that's down to the manager
and the individuals.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I guess it's different for different
individuals
teams.
Individuals as well. But yeah. By the way, all you can do is try your best and you get yourself in. If you've got an opportunity to win the league, you've done brilliantly to get yourself in that position in the first place. So don't be afraid of it. Be proud of what you've done and take the confidence and belief from what you've done.
Yeah.
Try and go and finish it off.
But did you sense nerves at the end at Blackburn in the dressing room? Because the games were kind of tense at the end, weren't they? And that's normal.
But I'd won it before.
Yeah.
Right? And I was still nervous.
Yeah.
I don't think Batty ever get nervous.
No.
He just never bothered. But, as I say, you do get nervous, but there's nothing wrong with nerves.
No, nerves show you care. That's what I say.
Well, I don't know.
And you
I
can,
don't know, but there's nothing wrong with it. But it's like everything else; it's got to be managed.
Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. I've got another one for you. This one is from Callum Munsekenny. What are Sir Kenny's thoughts on a potential Superliga? That's what Bayern Munich recently have been talking about, getting all the big clubs together into a league of their own, and then and financial fair play as a whole, as it seems to all it seems to do is prevent any smaller clubs ever breaking into the European elite.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if take the second one first. I don't know of any club that's ever won a league or a cup when they've no spent money. And the good clubs are the ones that spend less than what they've brought in. I mean, if you spend more than what you bring in, you're going to be in trouble. And if there's going to be a financial fair play, then surely they've got to adhere to that. That if they go over and above whatever the rules and regulations are, then there's got to be a punishment. And it's not just a punishment for people who have won the league, and it's not a claim from people who have finished second and third. What about the people, if you break the financial fair play rules, what about the people that have been relegated? You know, they've lost a lot of money as well. So there's got to be some, if they put a rule in place, they should adhere to it. But there's no point in putting rules in place if you're not going to have suitable punishment for anybody who breaks it.
What if you broke financial fair play rules, to your point, to sign somebody off a team who then got relegated?
Well, there's a load of ifs and buts and maybes and what ifs, but the rules are there. It tells you whatever it is financially, you can't overspend, and there's going to be a punishment. Now, finding them isn't a punishment, but the problem they've got in trying to control what their income is there is no limit, and they cannot limit the clubs to secondary sponsors. So you've got a group, you've got your shirt sponsor, you've got the sponsors on your sleeve, but they can't stop you having two boards full of secondary sponsors. If you get somebody, like said, somebody owns a club and they're also very wealthy, and they're handing out contracts in their other walk of life, they can say, well, you've got a £200 million contract here to build a railway line or something. But out of that, I want you to sponsor the club for 4 years and 20 grand a year for secondary sponsors. How did you stop that if you get 10 of them?
Yeah, and that's pretty much what the allegations are, that, you know,
there's
Manchester City apparently, and PSG. Basically, their owners are, you know, getting sponsors in, but then paying the sponsors to sponsor them, kind of thing. Do you get what I mean? So that's where they're saying it's getting a bit dodgy, so to speak.
Well, I don't know, because if they have overspent, I don't know if they have, or what rules are broken, but they do have to be punished. And if they want to get a Super League,
they've broken a rule.
Yes.
If they've broken a rule, that's what I said.
Yeah.
But if they're trying to get a Super League together, what's going to be the promotion and relegation? Who's going to come in for the Premier League? And why really does the Premier League need it if they're talking purely football? Maybe financially they'll get more money in.
Yeah.
But how much money does anybody need? Does it improve the product? I don't know. Maybe bottom four, five, or six teams. Yeah, you could maybe get a wee bit better quality of opposition than that. But then, how did he work out the promotion and relegation? There's got to be promotion and relegation, or it just dies a day. It just dies.
Yeah. And Paul, you're fighting that. We've had a whole podcast about that, haven't we? In the US and soccer, so US soccer. So you're well versed in that one. Okay, let's move on. Let's go to a question from Gummel. So Kenny, what was the process when it came to recruitment during your second term at LFC? Did Damien Camori recommend players, and then did he discuss them with you, or did you give Damien a list of players? How did it work?
Well, you have a certain amount of knowledge myself on players, because although you're not working, you still watch football on the telly. It's better than some of the soaps, so might as well watch the football and keep an interest, keep your hand in. But Damien was, obviously he had players also that the club had been watching with Roy, and before that. And, I was privy to what the list and what the comments were of the players that he had the list of. Also, I had my own list, and we put the two together. I'd go and have a look at maybe some of the people he'd put forward, and then go and look at the list that I had and the names I had in my own mind. And at the end of the day, I would pick the player, and he would be the one that would come in, or if anybody was coming in. Damien never ever pushed forward a player, and forced him to come on board without my 100% agreement. So for me, no being, naughty in describing the job. It's the title's called Director of Football, but for me, the only thing that was different between that and when I was there the first time was the title of the person who was scouting the players. And that was, he was a chief scout, and the modern day term was a director of football or a sporting director. For me, he was invaluable because he negotiated the players' contracts. He did the financials. And all I did was choose a player that I wanted to come in. And saying that, right after the first game, came back after the Man United game at Old Trafford into the office, and Damien said, just 2 minutes, he said, we need a coach. I said, okay, he gave me a couple of names, picked Stevie Clark, and Stevie was there the next day to start work. I also mentioned a couple of players. Suarez was one, and I said, just sign him. I said, I've seen him play umpteen times on the television with Ajax. Just sign him.
Love it.
And absolutely, he went away and got it. So Damien was very, very helpful. Mm. And watching players, bringing players' names back to us, asking me to go and have a look at the players, either on tape or live, and then it's whoever you picked, he would try and go and get for you.
Wow.
Now, that might not be how everybody's director of football or football director, whatever they call it, work, right? But that's definitely how Damien worked with me.
But Dad, like everything, the number one target, you don't always get, you know, so you can,
no.
And that, so it's, what people maybe don't see at the back end is that it's not always who you want to sign it. As you say that all the time, it's who wants to sign for you.
Yeah,
and that's the most important part of recruitment.
Yeah. But that's different to what they're accusing some of the directors of football are doing.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens to anybody. If the guy doesn't want to come, or his wife doesn't want to come, then you're not going to sign him, are you?
No,
but
that's
different. Yeah? That's a different discussion to what it is when you're saying they were interfering, and the players that they wanted, they came in. And for Damien, I would stick up 200% for him, because he never ever did that with me.
No, I agree, but obviously, we're not going to go into names, but just from my point of view, I know players that have been wanted, so to speak, but then at the end of the day, if they don't want to come, that you've got to move on to the next one on the list.
Yeah.
And that's it. So like some of the players that, you know, and it would be exciting to have seen some of the players, but that's, you know, at the time when you were at Liverpool, Dad, Liverpool wasn't as an attractive place for players to come. I don't think there's any harm in saying that as it is now. I think it's one of the most attractive places to come. Whereas when you were there, it wasn't. It wasn't a place where people were as keen to come to as they are now.
Oh, but what you do is you draw up your list for a certain position. You go for your number one target. If you don't get that, you go for your number two.
Yeah.
And by the way, you don't need to have 5 and 6 for each position.
No.
Because if you don't reach a quality that you think that you really need, you don't bring them.
Yeah, because there's no point replacing somebody with the same. They've got to improve what you've currently got, or there's no point spending money.
Correct.
And so, Kenny, whilst you're at this one, what was the differences in signing a player in 1988 to 2012? This comes in from Kieran.
Well, I don't know what you mean, differences.
Like, was there a difference in how you recruited a player, or was it exactly the same what you did? What was done?
No, you scout the player first. Yeah. I mean, and that's exactly the procedure that I was telling you that went through with Damien.
So there's no change.
The first time around, I had to look at them as well. And you've got greater access to them now.
Mm.
So much coverage of football that you see, people
start all different programs that you can watch players in, and you can watch games from all over the world now without leaving the house or the office. But here's one thing that you'd maybe think of, Dad. There was no signing a player. I would imagine takes a lot longer now for the contracts to be negotiated, because the contracts, I would say, are a lot more complicated now than what they were when you were at Liverpool the first time, with image rights and different things, how contracts are broken down for wages, image rights, different things. Would that be fair?
I would imagine that would be the case. I never get involved in the financial discussions with players. If the club come and said to me, you've got a couple of million quid, you want to go and buy a player, then fine. Damien would then go out and try and get what the wages, get it agreed with the player or no agreed. So, I mean, it still came down to the bit where you don't always get who you want.
Well, that was...
Sometimes it's finance, it stops it.
Yeah, that's it. That's what I was going to say, Dad. What I didn't really understand, obviously I understand it now, but maybe it's fans as well. And I think Liverpool fans are quite educated when it comes to this, because we've got a lot of people that produce really detailed content on the financial breakdown of the way football works. But if somebody was a £10 million transfer fee and they were on £20,000, they're on £20,000 for 5 years, then that's £15 million. So you've got to do half again in terms of wages. If they were on £40,000, then that's £10 million in wages, £10 million on a transfer fee. And sometimes the higher the wages, the less the transfer fee costs, because there's less teams that can afford them, and the current team just wants them off the wage bill. So it's when wages aren't public, it's very, very difficult to know exactly how much the total deal for a player is, and in a lot of cases the wages can add up to more than the transfer fee, and that's normally, as you said, Dad, where a lot of the bigger name transfers that you want to go after that fall through normally come down to, because the club, unless you're a superpower, aren't in the position to pay the wages for the best players.
Probably it can stop for many reasons.
Yeah.
Even as I said earlier, if somebody's no happy about coming to live in the district, whether it's the player or his wife, if the wife says, "Oh, I want to go and live in London, I don't want to come to the Northwest," then fine. I mean, what can you do? You can't relocate to London just because the player's wife wants to live there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that stop transfers going through. And nowadays, it's even possible that it could be the agent not happy with what he was being paid.
Unbelievable! Yeah. Unbelievable!
And well, Dad, the other thing as well is other thing is the amount of tax that is taken off the player in that country.
Wow!
You know, because in different countries have different tax rates.
So many factors now.
Yeah,
but there's always been that with players because the movement in and around Europe and further afield is a lot more prevalent now. Then you do get more and more issues coming in to make it more difficult or less of an opportunity for you to get the guy in, and the tax would come into it. There's a lot of things you'll bring into it, but as I say, that's why it's best just to leave it and let people who have that as an education or have that as a 40 to go and discuss it and either agree or otherwise. And you can just sit there. Your expertise is in football, judging somebody's ability to play. No judging somebody's worth for his wages. So if everybody does their own job and doesn't cross over, then you've got a better chance of being successful.
Well, to link back to your original point, to a previous question about the assistant coach, you need to bring in somebody that can do what you can't do. It's the same thing with the person that works above you, who's negotiating these deals. You've got to make sure that you're compatible with that person as well.
Yeah. But I don't think it's rocket science.
No.
The more people that work at the club who do a good job in their respective field, the better chance you have of being successful at your football club.
Agreed, yeah.
Absolutely no danger.
And we're lucky at the moment, Dad. There's a lot of good people at the club.
Oh, Paul, our club's flying. Mm-hmm. Our club's in an excellent position at the moment.
Okay, let's finish this pod on a real light note. So Jed Folk asks you, Sakedi, strangest pre-match player ritual that you've witnessed during your playing or managerial career, whether it's a Liverpool player or opposition.
Oh, well, I wouldn't know the oppositions, would I?
True.
Because I wouldn't have been in the dressing room. Yeah, I'd only be here.
That's right.
Obviously, Bruce Grobber, who's, I think, has got a book out at the moment. Mm-hmm. Bruce was apart from being an excellent goalkeeper, he was a bit of a character as well. And he used to have a wee, I don't know if ritual's the right word, but it was preparation for the game. He used to get the ball and there was a light switch. He just pressed up or down to put the light on or off. So obviously in the dressing room, the lights were on. So he used to like just bounce a ball and let a half volley or drop it and volley it. And it had to hit the switch and put the light off or on, whatever it was, before he could move on to the next stages, getting prepared for the match. So we went to play at Wimbledon at Plough Lane and Bobby Gould was the manager. And he said, he said, I've done you there. He said, before the game, we went in for a drink afterwards. I says, well, I don't know what you're on about, Bob. He says, the light switch. I said, yeah. He says, well, we put the switch up, we took the switch off and just put a cover over it. So that the light was going to be permanent, whether we did switched it on or switched it off. You couldn't reverse it. He said, so we just put a plain cover on it. I said, oh, very good. I don't know. What's your point, caller? He said, Grobler, as part of his routine before the game, used to volley the ball off it to knock the switch on or off. I says, he does, yeah. He says, well, I just thought it maybe upset him a wee bit. I said, Bob, you've lost the game 2-1, right? And I'll tell you something else. He only does it at home.
Brilliant. Love it. That is great. So
that was,
Brucey.
That was it.
And legend.
Ronnie Whelan used to be sick before the game.
Oh, wow. Really?
His wife was a good cook as well, but he was always sick.
Paul, did you see anything when in your playing days or as a manager? Have you seen any interesting rituals, mate?
No, I mean, I've seen... You see them. Some people put the socks on a certain foot first. Or there was a guy over here that plays, and he always wears his shorts back to front. Goes out on the pitch with his shorts back to front for the game. And you see, I mean, you see it enough. You have some people that... some of the coaching staff want to have a drink, you know, for good luck before the game, or yeah, there's all different things that go on. But the worst ones are the guys that don't change the shin pads for don't wash the shin pads or wear the same shin pads or create any stink, as you don't want to be sat next to them.
Brilliant.
But it's there's
that's really, probably why Ronnie was feeling sick.
Yeah. I didn't wear shin pads, so it couldn't be me.
No, but there's some, like, you've got to be careful, because there's some of them you don't, some of them have got to stay in the dressing room, so you've got to there's certainly some people that do different things before games.
You know, see before a game, when Bob Paisley was manager.
Yeah.
I mean, we never went on the pitch or anything beforehand, and the warm-ups weren't great. They could go and watch in the players' lounge. You could watch the race, right? If it was a sprint race, like 5 furlongs or something, they could even watch the race start at 2:30 or 2:55 and be in time, and old Bob would be with them watching the racing. And they leave the players' lounge, walk up, and start getting ready for the game.
Yeah.
And it wasn't frowned upon, Bob.
No.
I mean, Bob wouldn't cut. He wouldn't have frowned upon it because he was there as well.
He had money on it. They've now got the TVs in the dressing room, though, haven't they? So.
Nah, but they couldn't have put horse racing on in the dressing room.
Depends.
Mind you, they might have.
Yeah. There you go.
There you go. Thank you so much, guys. I think it's probably a good, ideal place to draw close to this episode of The King and AI. I have to say, a massive, massive honour for me to host both of you. Thank you so much, Sir Kenny. This is also like, it's 5 years this week to the AI podcast actually becoming a podcast as well. So it's been 5 years. So very nice to speak to you on that time at 5 years. But,
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. So just wanted to say thank you so much to both of you, for spending the time, and, really, really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Not a problem.
Excellent. And you subscribers and listeners, please, 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 please do go and donate to the Marina Dalglish Appeal. We would really appreciate it. It's anfieldindex.com/MDA. And also, there's another way you can help, and we're going to close the show as Kelly Cates comes and tells you exactly what you can do.
Thanks very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. There is one more thing that you could do, but it doesn't really require any effort. If you use Amazon, if you go to smile.amazon.co.uk, there's an option to select a charity. If you select the Marina Dalglish Appeal, then every time you make a purchase at Amazon, they will make a donation to the charity. All you have to do is use smile.amazon.co.uk as your website to buy things from Amazon. It should, in theory, be quite straightforward. Thanks very much again.
Podcast Network.